In the center of the Gilgal, a peculiar stone was set upright, coal-black and cone-shaped, obviously fallen from heaven and possessing heavenly powers. Its form suggested the organ of generation. Therefore Jacob piously saluted it with lifted eyes and hands, and felt greatly strengthened thereby. Here he would spend the night, to the rising of the day. He chose for a headrest one of the stones of the circle, and addressing it, "Come," he said, "faithful old stone, lift up for a night the head of the persecuted." He spread his headcloth upon it, and lay down with his head toward the phallic emissary from the skies, blinked a little at the stars, and fell asleep. Then it was, high matters came to pass. Then truly toward midnight, after some hours of profound slumber, his head was lifted up from every ignominy, even to the countenance of the Most High, wherein mingled all of the royal and of the divine which his soul had ever compassed in its imaginings, which that soul then, humbled yet smiling privily in its abasement, erected for its own strengthening and consolation in the space of its dream. Yet he dreamed himself not away from the place, for in his dream, too, he lay there with his head propped up and slept. But his eyelids were pervious to a plenitude of brilliant light. He saw through them, saw Babel, saw the naval cord of heaven and earth, the stair up to the palace of the Lord, the wide and fiery unnumbered steps, beset with astral watchers, whose mighty slope led up to the uppermost temple and dwelling-place of the Most High. They were not stone, nor wood, nor any earthly substance. They seemed of molten bronze, and built of the stuff that is of the stars, and their starry brilliance lost itself in measureless breadth upon the earth, and mounted upward so high and wide and blinding as to be unbearable to the open eye, so that one saw them through the lids alone. Winged creatures, half man, half beast, cherubim, cows with crowns and virgins' faces, their pinions folded, stood motionless on both sides, and gazed straight ahead of them. Their striding legs, first forward and then back, left spaces that were filled in with bronze tablets, inscribed with holy writings. Bull gods, with bands of pearl across the brow, and earlocks that hung down as long as the fringe-shaped beards ending in rows of curls, crouched with their heads turned outwards, so that they gazed at the sleeper with quiet, long-lashed eyes. With these alternated lion-like forms that sat upon their tails, their arching chests covered with fiery manes. They seemed to hiss from square, wide-open jaws. The hairs stood out fiercely beneath their flat noses. But the whole width of the stair, between these animals, was alive with messengers and servants, pacing up and down in measured tread, like a slow movement of a dance, as in joyous conformity to heaven's law. The lower half of their bodies was shrouded in garments covered with pointed script. Their bosoms seemed too soft for those of youths, too flat for those of maidens. With arms uplifted, they bore basins on their heads, or else a tablet in the crook of one arm, pointing at it with the finger of the other hand. But many played on harps and flutes, or struck on lutes and drums. Behind them stood singers who filled all space with high, metallic, sibilant voices, and kept time with clapping hands. Thus, the whole breadth of this stair between the worlds was one mighty wave of harmonious sound. Downwards, and upwards as far as the narrow, flaming, fiery arch that was the gateway of the palace with pillars and lofty pinnacles. The pillars were of golden bricks, from which projected scaly beasts with 4 feet of leopards and behind the feet of eagles. And the jambs of the fiery gate on either side had the feet of bulls and crowns with fourfold horns and eyes of precious stones, and curled beards bound up in clusters on their cheeks. But in front stood the golden seat of the kingly power and the golden footstool, and behind it a man with bow and quiver, who held a long-handled fan over the mitre crown of the power, and it was adorned with a drapery woven out of moonlight and had fringes of tiny flames. and the arms of God were full of the nerves of power, and in one hand he held the sign of life, and in the other a drinking vessel. His beard was blue, and held together with bronze bands, and beneath his high-arched brows his countenance was awful in stern benignity. Before him was another man, with a wide band round his head, like to a vizier and a servant closest to the throne, who looked into the face of the power, and motioned with his open hand towards Jacob sleeping on the earth. Then the Lord inclined his head, and stood up on his sinewy foot, and the servant hasted to stoop and take away the footstool that the Lord might stand. And God stood up before the throne, and held out towards Jacob the sign of life, and breathed in the air into his lungs, so that his breast rose high, and the splendor of his voice accorded with the psaltery and the star music of those that moved up and down upon the stair, and was taken up into mild and mighty harmony. But he spake, I am. I am the Lord of Abraham, and the Lord of Isaac, and thy Lord. My eye looks upon thee, Jacob, with far-seeing favor, for I will make thy seed unnumbered as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt be to me blessed before all, and keep the gates of thine enemies. And behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and bring thee again rich into this land where thou sleepest, and never forsake thee. I am, and I will. Thus thundered in harmony the voice of the king, and Jacob awaked. What a dream and a vision had that been! What a lifting up of the head! Jacob wept for joy, laughing the while at the thought of Eliphaz as he walked about under the stars within the circle of stones, and saw that one whereon his head had rested while he gazed. What place is this, he thought, upon which I am fallen by chance? He was cold from the freshness of the night, and shivered to his depths from excitement as he spoke. Surely it is right that I so shiver, for the people of Luz know naught of this place, though indeed they have made a sanctuary here and a Gilgal, yet surely they know as little as I knew that it is a place of the presence and the gate of splendor and a bond between heaven and earth. Later he slept again, a few hours of deep and prideful sleep, full of privy laughter. But at dawn he arose and went down to Luz and sought the bazaar, for he had in the folds of his girdle a seal ring with a deep blue lazuli stone, which the servants of Eliphaz had missed in their search. This he sold for a price. For dry food to eat, and 2 jars of oil, which latter he particularly needed for a purpose which he had in mind, and conceived to be his duty. Before he went on eastwards and towards the river Neharina, he climbed the hill once more to the place of his dream, lifted up the stone against which he had slept, set it erect as a monument, and poured oil lavishly upon it, saying, Beth-El, Beth-El shall be the name of this place, and not Luz, for it is a house of the presence, and God the King hath revealed himself here to his humble servant, and strengthened his heart above all measure. For surely it was beyond bounds and an exaggeration that which he called out to me amid the music of the harps, that my seed should be countless as the dust, and my name be high in honor. But if he will be with me, as he promised, and keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God, and I will give him a tenth of all that he giveth me. And if all this be fulfilled, with which he hath so boundlessly strengthened my heart, then shall this stone which I have set up for a pillar be God's house, wherein nourishment shall be brought to him without end, and moreover strong-smelling incense burned for his nostrils. This is my vow and my promise against the other promise, and may God the King now do as seemeth to him in his interest. Esau. Thus, then, had it been with Eliphaz, the splendid youth, who, after all, was but a poor stripling compared with Jacob, whom he had humbled as a sacrifice to his pride. For Jacob, thanks to resources of spiritual strength unknown to Eliphaz, had triumphed with ease over such humiliations as a boy could force upon him, and it was precisely out of the depth of the abasement that the revelation had come. And how had it been with the father? Had his experience differed from that of the son? I mean, in that meeting with Esau to which we have heard Jacob refer. In this case, the exaltation and strengthening had come first, at Peniel, in that night of fear, when he had wrestled for the name that made Simeon and Levi smile. And in possession of the name, already triumphant, he had gone to meet his brother, armed beforehand against any humiliation which might prove unavoidable, armed as well against the indignity of his own fear of an encounter that was to display once more to the full the unlikeness between the twin brothers. He had himself, convinced that the situation was no longer tenable and must be cleared up, sent messages to his brother, but he could not tell in what spirit Esau was approaching. He knew through spies that his brother had put himself at the head of 400 men, which might be interpreted as an honor due to the meek and flattering messages he had sent, or equally might represent an actual danger. He had made his preparations. His nearest and dearest, Rachel, and her 5-year-old son, he had hidden behind the laden camels, and laid Dinah, his daughter by Leah, as dead in a coffin, where she nearly smothered. The other children he had ranged with their mothers, the concubines and their offspring, in the lead. He had the herdsmen draw up the present of cattle, the 200 he-goats and she-goats, the same number of rams and ewes, the 30 camel mares in suck, the 40 cows and 10 bull calves, the 20 she-asses with their foals. All these he arranged in echelon, and had them driven in single herds with space between each two, so that Esau might ask of each in turn, and learn that they were for him, a present from his servant Jacob. Thus it came to pass. And though when Esau left the mountains of Seir to meet the returned wanderer, his mood may still have been very vacillating, unclear even to himself, by the time he once more, after the lapse of 25 years, met his brother face to face, his spirits were of the highest. However much Jacob may have set himself to effect it, he found this blitheness quite out of place. No sooner had he grasped the fact that for the moment at least he had nothing to fear, than he found it hard to conceal his disgust at Esau's brainless good-heartedness. Never did he forget the scene of his brother's approach. Rebekah's twin sons were at this time 55 years old, the sweet-smelling grass and the prickly plant, as they had been known in all the countryside between Hebron and Beersheba. But the sweet-smelling grass, the smooth man, Jacob, had never behaved very youthful. A tent-dweller, thoughtful and timid, he had shown himself even as a boy. And now he was a ripe man with much experience, heavy with goods that had accrued unto him, preoccupied in spirit, bearing with dignity the weight of events. And on the other hand, Esau, though like his brother gray-haired, seemed still to be as of yore, the same feckless, insignificant child of nature, always either wailing in grief or bursting with animal spirits. Nor did he look to have altered in face, for in fact most of the changes we see in our boyhood companions consist in their having grown beards and added a wrinkle or so to a physiognomy which remains as boyish as ever. What Jacob first heard of the oncoming Esau was the sound of the pipes, the well-remembered high and hollow trilling on a bundle of reeds of different lengths, held together by crosswise bands. It was an instrument beloved of the dwellers in the mountains of Seir, and perhaps invented by them. Esau had early acquired one, and taught his thick lips to draw out therefrom most pleasing music. Jacob knew of old, and hated the foolish and abandoned tunefulness of the sounds, the irresponsible tra-la-la that was native to the underworld of the south. Scorn rose in his soul as his ears caught the first notes. And Esau was dancing, his pipe at his lips, his bow at his back, a flutter of goat-skin round his loins, but otherwise no clothing, for he was so hairy that he really did not need it, and the fleece hung down in reddish grizzled tangles from his shoulders. With his pointed ears and his nose lying flat on his upper lip, he danced and sprang across the open meadow towards his brother and his brother's train, blowing, becking, laughing and weeping, until Jacob, between shame and scorn, and pity and disgust, could only think to himself something like, "For heaven's sake!" At all events, he got down from his beast as fast as his swollen thigh permitted, and, holding up his garment, hastened to drag himself towards the musical goat, and on the way to give all the evidence of submission and self-abasement which he had set himself to perform. They came much easier to his self-esteem after the triumph of the night before. Some 7 times he flung himself down, despite his pain, with the palms of his hands above his bent head, and thus he arrived at Esau's feet, and pressed his forehead to them, while his hands reached up to his brother's fleecy knees, and his lips repeated the words, which, despite the blessing and the curse, were to put the whole situation in a light completely favorable to Esau, and thus to disarm and reconcile him, "My lord, thy servant." But Esau's attitude was not only one of appeasement, it was actually friendly and tender beyond all expectation, even most likely his own, for his feeling upon having news of his brother's return had been merely a vague and general excitement, which even up to just before the meeting might quite as easily have turned to rage as to tenderness. He seized Jacob up from the dust, pressed him with audible sobs to his hairy bosom, and kissed him with loud smacks on lips and cheeks. The caresses were almost more than Jacob could stand. Yet he wept himself. Partly because his fears proving groundless, the tension was relaxed, partly out of his own nervous sensibility, but largely, in general, over life and time and the destiny of humankind. "Oh, my brother, my brother!" babbled Esau between his kisses. "All is forgiven, all the knavishness of aforetime, all!" So painfully explicit a forgiveness was calculated to dry Jacob's tears at once, rather than to make them flow more freely. And Esau passed on to speak of things of moment, leaving, however, to the last, the question which interested him most, namely the meaning of the herds that had been driven up in advance of Jacob's party. And first, with lifted brows, he inquired about the women and children on the camels behind his brother. These then dismounted and advanced to be presented. First the concubines, with their 4 children, bowed before the hairy one, then Leah, with her 6, and last, the sweet-eyed Rachel, with Joseph, was fetched up from the rear. As each name was mentioned, Esau gave a little flourish on his pipes, praised the women's bosoms and the sturdiness of the offspring. He commented loudly upon Leah's weak eyesight, and gave her an Edomite herb balsam for her chronically inflamed lids, at which she kissed the tips of his toes and thanked him with rage in her heart. Even the outward forms of the reconciliation made some difficulty. Both brothers tried to speak in the language of their common childhood, but found it hard. Esau spoke the harsh dialect of Seir, which differed from his native tongue by the addition of Midianitic words and elements from the desert of Sinai, whereas Jacob had learned in Naharina to speak Akkadian. They helped each other out with gestures, but Esau found words for his curiosity in the matter of the far herds, and his offhand manner of receiving the splendid present, when Jacob indicated that by its means he hoped to find favor in his brother's eyes, showed that he was not without a knowledge of good breeding. He affected a blithe indifference to property and riches and all such like burdens. "By no means, O my brother," he cried out. "It were exceeding folly. Take it and keep it. I return it thee back. I have no need of it to forget the disgraceful old tale and to forgive it. I have come to terms with my lot and am content. Dost thou imagine that we of the lower world go about all our days with our tails between our legs? That were to believe most mistakenly. Praise be to God. We do not swagger, indeed, or roll our eyes because of the blessing on our head, but in our own way we are of good cheer. To us, too, it is sweet to lie with a woman. We, too, cherish love for the children we breed. Think'st thou the curse I owe thee, rascally brother that I love, made me a scurvy beggar and starveling in Edom? Not so, for there I am a lord, and great among the sons of Seir. I have more wine than water, abundance of honey, oil, and fruits, and wheat, and barley, more than I can eat. My underlings bring me fowls, they send me bread and flesh meat every day, and game ready prepared for the meal, and venison that they hunt in the wild with their dogs, and also that I myself kill. And milk dishes have I, to make me lie awake half the night with belching. Presents? Flocks and herds as sin offering and eyewash, to make me forget the ancient filthy wrong done upon me by the woman and by thee? Fie upon it! Fie! Here he gave a flourish on his pipes. What need of presents betwixt thee and me? For the heart is all, and I have forgiven and forgotten the ancient baseness, nor think any more how thou mockst me and my hairiness before our father with skins upon thy thigh and thy wrist, thou rascal, so that I laugh even in my old age as I remember it, though then I wept bloody tears and sent after thee Eliphaz and made thee to grow pale with fear, thou woman's man. And he embraced his brother afresh and smeared kisses all over his face, Jacob simply enduring without showing any response. For he was disgusted to his very core with Esau's words, finding them brainless and lewd and utterly painful, and thinking of nothing save how to get free with utmost dispatch of this strange-like relative, only not without having regulated the situation and quit him once more for the birthright with tribute paid down on the spot. For, of course, Esau only wanted to be urged. So there was further exchange of courtesies, more self-abasements, more pressing offers, until at last, when Esau let himself be persuaded to take the gift from his brother's hand and be grateful for it, the poor devil's heart was really won over, and he was far more sincerely reconciled with Jacob than Jacob by any means found it in his heart to be with him. "And now, my brother," Esau cried, "not another thought of that shabby old affair. For came we not out of the same womb, thou and I, one after the other, and as good as at the same time? For thou heldst my ankle, as thou knowest, and I, the stronger, dragged thee behind me into the light of day. We had fought with each other in the womb, forsooth, and outside it too. But let there be an end to all that. Let us live brotherly with one another, and like twins before the Lord, and dip the hand in the same dish, and depart not each from the side of the other for the rest of our lives. Up, then, and let us take our journey toward Seir, and let us dwell together." "Thanks very much," was Jacob's thought to himself. "Go to Edom, shall I, and be a piping he-goat like thee, and live forever with thee, thou fool? But that is not the meaning of God, nor of my soul. All that thou speak'st is but empty and idle words in my ear, for that which happened between us will not be buried. Thou thyself bring'st it into every word that thou utterest, while thinking in thy feeble wits it can be forgiven and forgotten." Aloud he said, "The words of my lord are an enchantment, and each one singly has hearkened to the inmost wishes of his servant's heart. But my lord seeth that with me are my half-grown children, likewise little ones of five, like this one here named Jehoseph, a weakling on a journey, and then, alas, a dead child in the coffin, whom it were impious to harry over stock and stone, not to speak of my sucking calves and lambs. All these would die were I to hasten. Let my lord, I pray thee, pass over before his servant, and I will lead on softly, according as the cattle that go before me and the children are able to endure, until I come unto my lord at Seir to dwell fondly together."